in perimeter. Everybody told me perimeter is fantastic, and just after I think just 2-3 hours, I realized that indeed it seems like a very appealing place to be. So the talk is going to be mostly about dark matter, and what I want to show you is that even though it's just the beginning, there may be a new probe to find the microphysics of dark matter. So it's going to be a little bit cosmologically oriented, but hopefully you will see why I think it is important. So before I really start, let me just remind you, can you hear me fine? Or, yeah. I just want to remind you that in the last decade and 2 decades, we've done a lot of progress in cosmology, and in particular, now we've been able to map the distribution of matter, the angular distribution, but also really the distribution in space. And what you see here is images, is a film realized from the SDSS survey. What you see is essentially the distribution of matter in the universe, in the past universe, but really close to us. So it's not going very far. However, what is clear from this film is that the universe is full of little structures. And all the points, most of the points are actually galaxies. So what we learn from this is that there are plenty of galaxies around and plenty of little objects. And the question is, how do you explain it? So you have to explain the distribution, but you also have to explain the number. Now, what we learn from the CMB experiment, which mapped the angular distribution of matter and the position and number of structure, what we learn is that we cannot explain both observations without introducing a new type of matter, and this matter has to be invisible, essentially. So then the question is, if it's an invisible type of matter, what is it? Do we know it already, or do we have to invent something new? And so all the talk is about what kind of new type of particles it could be. So the main lesson that we learn from the surveys of galaxies is precisely that to explain the distribution of matter as we see, and if we try to compare it to our prediction, we realize that you need something which is obviously invisible, so therefore, by extension, using the stellar model, you think it could be weakly interacting. Now, this assumes that you have particles. This is one big assumption. And then it's assumed really that in between electromagnetic interaction and weakly interaction, there is nothing. And that's another big assumption which I'm going to question. But the thing which is pretty certain is that if you want to explain galaxies, to explain exactly this distribution, you need a type of matter which is massive. So you need a mass, and if you're dealing with particles, you obviously need a mass for each of the particles. So they need to be heavy enough in order to cluster and form galaxies. So together, the fact that you can assume that the dark matter doesn't have large interactions and the fact it's massive gives you something which is called the cold dark matter paradigm. And we've seen that actually, even though there may be deviation, so far so good, it is actually fitting the observations. But there is a lesson from the CMB itself that we learned. Most people actually deduce from the CMB. Sorry, I just need to remember how to use the pointer, not to kill myself. So everybody looking at this map deduce actually that there is about 30% of dark matter. The number changes depending on the accuracy of the last experiment which mapped the CMB. But roughly there's something like 30%, 27% of dark matter, and 68% of dark energy. But so a lot of people actually pay attention to those numbers. But I think what is actually more important is the distribution, the angular distribution of structure that they observe. And this is summarized in this plot. So I'm sure you've seen it thousands of times. But let me just summarize again. So this is the number of structure for a given size. And this is a large scale, this is a small scale. You see about 7 or 8 acoustic peaks, which acoustic peaks meaning that you have a fight between the matter and radiation. And those peaks actually tell you something extremely fundamental. So why am I insisting on this? Because at the end of the day, we don't know what is a dark matter. It could be, as I say, a new form of matter, but maybe it is actually something else, like a modification of gravity. Now, modifying gravity is extremely difficult, but if you do modify gravity, you do have to reproduce the CMB. And to reproduce those 7 and 8 peaks, it is, I think, almost impossible nowadays, unless someone comes with a new theory. So one theory which I thought was extremely compelling was proposed in 2004 by Jacob Bekenstein. And at the time, so it's called TEVS. So what is done is instead of having just a normal tensor, it was modifying by adding a scalar field and a vector field. So all the people who do modification of gravity, generally they have a tensor plus scalar, but you, at the time, at least, people didn't really think about adding the vector. So in principle, you have two new degrees of freedom. So you think maybe this is going to be easier to fit the observation from the CMB. With Konstantinos Kordis, another collaborator, Konstas actually was here at Perimeter a few years ago. And when I saw this paper by Jacob Bekenstein, we thought, well, actually, that's not going to work because you don't have dark matter and you would have an effect which is called Vessel damping, which I'm going to describe after. So we thought, well, we can just, you know, do the calculation. It's going to take us 1 month, and then we'll show that this doesn't work. It took us 1.5 years. And indeed, we found it doesn't work. But then after 1.5 years, you want to make it work. So I'm going to tell you what we've done exactly. So the first thing is TVS alone. So you try to do all the perturbation equation, but TVS alone is not, I mean, doesn't give you anything which fits the CMB. Even the first peak is off. But if you take TEVS and you say, well, we do know that there is dark energy, so we have to account for this lambda for the dark energy, then you get this this curve here. You have to compare it to the best model, which at the time was based actually just on 1 or 2 peaks from WMAP. And the best model was already lambda CDM, which is a blue curve. So what you see is that even the first peak with TEVS and lambda, you don't manage to reproduce. So you can already throw it out. However, then we thought, well, it doesn't work, but maybe you need something which looks like dark matter. But you just modify gravity, so you don't want to add dark matter on top. However, you know that there is a candidate in the solar model which is a dark matter candidate. It's a neutrino, because the neutrinos have weak interactions, and they're potentially massive with a small mass, but maybe it's enough. So by adding neutrinos and TEVS and dark energy, we obtain the red curve. And again, you see, you don't manage to reproduce lambda CDM, but the first two peaks are in better agreement. So at the time, we thought maybe this is not good, but maybe this is promising. However, the thing is now we measure, as I said, not only 2 peaks, but 7 or 8. And the 7 or 8, they tell you, I mean, with incredible precision. And they tell you it's really lambda CDM, at least up to those scales. So this curve, which is a red one, doesn't fit. And you can really try to modify it. And it's extremely hard to make it fit even the third peak. So the lesson for me is maybe you can modify gravity, but TEVS like this doesn't work. And it's really a lot of work to make it fit. On the other hand, you can assume that there is something which is called dark matter as a new particle. You don't need to know the mass. You don't need to know the cross-section. So it's pure magic. And it fits. It fits very well. So From this work, I decided that I like magic, and I was going to continue on magic for a while until someone very smart comes with a very, very nice modification of gravity. So everything I'm going to say now is assuming dark matter particles. Again, you could maybe say it's a new type of matter. Maybe it's not made of particles, but here I'm going to assume particles. Now, just one thing on this diagram. What you see here is, as I say, it doesn't fit because you have this suppression, and it's a suppression at small scales. And the reason why you have a suppression at small scales is essentially called silk damping. So the silk damping, I'm sure you heard about it many times, but the silk damping tells you that you have a suppression of small scales due to the baryon and photon interactions. So what happens is that to form galaxies and to form structures, you need fluctuations. Those fluctuations have a given size. And for the moment, I'm just going to assume a correspondence, a one-to-one correspondence. I'm going to assume that if I want to form a small galaxy, I need a small fluctuation full of matter. And if I want a cluster of galaxies, I need a very large fluctuation. Now, if the universe was only made of baryons, the baryons would interact with the photons. And because the photons are relativistic, and there are plenty of photons around, and the baryon-photon interactions are very efficient, every time you have such an interaction, the baryons are going to be dragged out of the fluctuation. They will dissipate, and they will actually, instead of clumping in a small structure, in a small fluctuation, they will actually go out and diffuse out and form a larger fluctuation. So what's going to happen is that even if you wanted to form small structure, starting with small fluctuation, you will never manage to do so because those baryon-photon interactions will always drag you out and always force you to form only very large structure. So you will never see small structure. And this is why you have a cutoff. If the universe was baryonic, what you would see is a suppression here of very small structure. Now, this is not what you observe. So essentially, you can say dark matter is not a baryon. And you can tell from the CMB itself, but you can tell also looking at the structure in the universe, and even by performing simulation. So the first one here, if you really have cold dark matter, so no interactions at all, so you're sure it's not a baryon, then in that case, you form plenty of galaxies in the universe, some small, some bigger, so you form a very rich universe. Now, if you have only a baryon, you form something which is close to that. It's not exactly that because I don't have actually the simulation just for a baryonic universe only, but it's fairly similar. So what you will see is that you won't have all those very small structures.
So just
they were a very old simulation with baryons, and somehow now it's really, I mean, you don't want to spend a lot of time, computing time, to redo something.
Of course. Do you still
Yeah, exactly. So everything would be above. I don't even know. I don't think people have looked again. I mean, it was clear that the distribution is incorrect. Yeah. So for example, the simulation we perform in Durham and with Carlos Frank facilities. And I think if I was telling him I want to do baryonic dark matter, he will not be very happy. So I wouldn't even dare. Yeah. But yeah, so I don't know the answer, but I think it would be hard. It would be delayed. Actually, I know the answer. It would be very delayed because you will lose. Exactly. So you would form perhaps a little bit, but very delayed for sure. Yeah. So then, once you're here, you say, well, actually, the universe looks rather like this. So, okay, so it looks like cold dark matter, and therefore, maybe you need indeed particles which are weakly interacting and massive, etc. But then how do you detect them? How can you prove this paradigm? And so people, I mean, I'm sure you're very familiar with this, but people are usually using three techniques. So the first one is to say, well, if you have such particles, they're going to clump in the halo surrounding the galactic disk. So our galaxy is here, but it's actually embedded in a structure which is much larger and which is essentially tracing the dark matter distribution. Now, if you have this means you have dark matter particles orbiting around us. So you can have, you can hope to detect them if they cross Earth and if they interact with your detector. So this is called direct detection. This is what people have done for many years. When I was a PhD student, long time ago maybe, it was basically, let's say, 2000, around 2000 or 1998 with the DAMA. It was 10 to minus 36, I think on this plot is somewhere here. That's where the people could do. This was the best shot people could do. And now in, let's say, 10, 15 years, people have gained 10 orders of magnitude in the direct detection limits. So gaining 10 to the 10 in a detection experiment, I think is really remarkable. So this is direct detection, but in the meantime, people also say, well, actually, because you have a halo of dark matter, maybe the dark matter behaves more or less like standard model particles. Maybe they do annihilate. If they annihilate, then they produce some cosmic rays, and those cosmic rays can also produce some electromagnetic emission. And so you can look for gamma rays, X-rays, radio, etc., from our dark matter halo. So you just have, now you need a telescope. But basically, you can search for an anomalous electromagnetic signal in the galaxy. And then the third technique, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, is using the LHC. But what I want to show you today is that there may be a fourth one. And this fourth one is going to be based on galaxy surveys. So really the distribution of matter as it's seen by experiments such as SDSS. And before I show you that, the first thing I'm going to do is what I was doing when I started with this idea, is basically doubt everything I know. And the first thing I can doubt about is whether dark matter is weakly interacting or not. So the thing I know is that, yeah, if dark matter was a baryon, I would have a suppression in the CMB, and this is not observed, and that's for sure. And what I know also is that if dark matter has no interaction, then this is lambda CDM, and this is in agreement with observation. back when I started, which was around 2000, I didn't have any any observation essentially. So I knew those two curves, but I didn't know where the observation would be. And then you can say, well, actually, even though you don't know where the observation can be, you can wonder if dark matter is interacting, maybe not strongly interacting, maybe not weakly interacting, just interacting in the middle, where would be the curve, the CMB curve? Would it be in between or really close to CDM? So that's the thing I want to show you. The first thing for that is to go back to exactly what we were doing with the silk damping. So if you start to say that the dark matter has interaction, then in principle, it has something, it's going to suffer from something which is very close to the silk damping. But obviously, it depends. I mean, for the silk damping, I was involving baryons and photons. Now, the question is, if you generalize it to dark matter, are you going to couple it to photons? In principle, you would say no, because dark matter is invisible. But again, it depends on the cross-section. And then you could couple it also to the neutrino, because there are plenty of neutrinos around. You could couple it to baryons, and so on. So the question is, can you generalize the silk damping to the dark matter, and to the dark matter interacting with any standard model particles? And the answer is yes. And you can do it exactly as I was doing for the silk damping. It's going to be exactly the same principle. You try to clump the dark matter in a little fluctuation. But if it's coupled to something else, and this something else is relativistic, then the particles are going to diffuse out and leave a fluctuation. So exactly in the same way as the silk damping, you can have, you can erase little fluctuation, and therefore you will suppress small scale structures. And so you can basically try to do this. And at the time, it was it was very early on, so I didn't have all the technology. But we came up with Richard Schaeffer, we came up with, a very clever way of doing it, which was computing the damping length. Obviously, now I will show you we have a better way of doing it. But at the time, what we say is that we can compute just the damping scale, so just the diffusion length. And this diffusion length is going to obviously depend on whether the dark matter is coupled to a species which is relativistic, whether it is coupled to a species which is very numerous. So if you have plenty of particles around, you're going to see them, so you're going to elastic scatter of this particle. And then it depends whether the interaction lasts a long time or not. So if interaction decouples, stop in the early universe, then you have no effect. But if it lasts for a long time, then the diffusion will drag you out eventually of a small fluctuation. So that's why here you have an integral over the time where during which the dark matter interacts with the species. Then it will depend on the energy density, and it depends on the velocity of those particles with which the dark matter is coupled to.
Why would the interaction depend on time?
So it's more the effect lasts as long as there are interactions. So I'm integrating the effect, the scattering, the diffusion, let's say, over the time where I can have interactions.
Because the density is high enough?
Because the density is high enough, and because the velocity is also high enough, which is the integral. Yes, yeah, that's right. So if the velocity is very small, then the effect will basically be, even if it lasts a long time, it will be completely negligible. So this was the old way of doing it, but it's actually giving the same result as a modern way. And the modern way, so this was just to give you the intuition of the effect. The modern way is obtained, obviously, by modifying the Boltzmann equation in the same way as you basically do for the baryon and photon interaction. So in the modern formalism with the Boltzmann equation, you have the equation for the velocity of the baryons, the baryonic fluid, and for the photon and the dark matter. And you couple the baryons and the photons this way. In the same way now, so and you can see there is no term, no dark matter interaction term, no interaction term for the dark matter. So you have only the potential and the, only gravity and the expansion of the universe. But now, if you assume that the dark matter is interacting, you have to include those interactions in the equation. So what happened now is that you had basically an interaction term. And because it's an interaction term between dark matter and the photons, for example, in that case, I have also to add an interaction term in the equation for the photons. So I have now coupled equations, one for the photon, one for the dark matter, on top of the normal physics. And this is what you obtain. So the first plot on the left is the old one, and the right is the new one. It's basically much more precision, but the physics is essentially the same. So with this one, what I can show you is that if the dark matter was strongly interacting, even more than a proton, in fact, you would get the blue curve. And clearly, so this is a CMB again, the acoustic peaks. You see that the first peak doesn't work even. You cannot reproduce it. So clearly, dark matter, if dark matter was coupled to a photon, to photons with a cross-section which would be larger than a baryon, it really doesn't work. But surprisingly enough, if I decrease the cross-section by a factor 10, I have this quantity, which is basically the normalization of the cross-section to the Thomson cross-section for a given mass. So just assume this is just a normalization. So if I decrease the cross-section by a factor of 10, so go from the blue curve to the red curve, you can see that just a factor 10 in the cross-section brings me closer to the CMB. And still, I mean, I can reproduce only the first peak, but not the rest. If I decrease by a factor 100 compared to the blue curve, I go to the green curve, which is much closer to the CMB, to the observed CMB. If I decrease by a factor 1,000, I'm underneath the black curve, which is lambda CDM. And this is a yellow curve, which you cannot see, but it's essentially is compatible with lambda CDM. So those, this plot tells you that even if you have relatively strong interaction between dark matter and photon, so let's say that even if it's 10 to minus 4 sigma Thomson, I'm around 10 to minus 30 centimeters square. So for dark matter photon interaction, it is really large. Even though I have something like this, actually I can explain this. I mean, I'm still compatible with the CMB.
So is the dark matter charged?
No, I don't need to assume that. Well, in principle, you would do by a loop. Such cross-section is too large, to be realistic anyway. I'm just trying to see what the data are telling me. And what the data tell me is that dark matter could be, well, in a sense, could be charged, if you want, effectively charged, let's say.
To I guess I'm just wondering that, I mean, if it's charged, then it could be other than that interaction with galactic in the field.
Yeah, exactly. So you wouldn't want to do that. So it has to be suppressed by loops and other mechanisms. But if you assume that you have those corrections, which in a sense couple you indirectly to the photons, just the CMB alone tells you that it's okay as long as the cross section is smaller than 10 to minus 30 centimeters square. Doesn't mean that it doesn't violate other constraints, but just the CMB alone tells you that in principle it is possible.
Are you assuming something about the mass of the experiment?
No, because this is what comes out in the equation is sigma over the mass. So here it's for a certain normalization, but then I can rescale. So here, for 10 to minus 30, I'm assuming indeed a mass of 100 GeV, yeah, sorry, if you want, for this specific value. But the 10 to minus 4 is true, is sigma over m, which is, yeah. And so now the modern version, actually, I thought maybe it would be different. Maybe, you know, with more precise tools, maybe we'll find something different. But no, we got exactly the same result. And in fact, even though, so this was in 2001, this is 2013. So in between 12 years, now we have all the Planck data. And with Planck data, we found exactly the same again, 10 to minus 4. So we didn't improve much, which was disappointing, but at the same time tells you that, yeah, well, the CMB data do not tell you that dark matter has to be completely, has no interaction at all with photons. It can, in principle, be. Now, the thing is, once you have a CMB spectrum, then you should also look at the distribution of matter in Fourier space. And there is a characteristic signature of interactions, of dark matter interaction, which is dark oscillations. So we found them in 2001, and then people started to see them after, also for the neutrinos, for coupling to neutrino, for coupling with baryons. I mean, it's more or less a characteristic you find everywhere as soon as you couple the dark matter. So what you obtain is those suppression of matter, of the matter power spectrum. Lambda CDM is this one, and then if you couple the dark matter, you see not only a damping, but those are oscillations. So the simulation of lambda CDM gives you plenty of structure, but now is really the real simulation. If you have one of those spectrum, you really see a deficit in the number of small scale structure. And this is normal because this is what you expect. You have less power at small scale, so this is exactly what you would imagine. Now the thing is, this is the universe as a whole, and now what I'm going to show you is simulation which really goes into the Milky Way. So I'm going to start with a simulation which is going to be as a whole universe, and then we're going to zoom in. So this is pure lambda CDM, But then we zoom in into something which looks like a Milky Way halo. And then we've done the same simulation with interaction, dark matter interacting, and then now we're going to do a zoom of a Milky Way halo in the case of a dark matter interacting with photons. It would work also with neutrinos. Now what you see is that you have much less on the right, you have much, well, on the right, but it turns, much less structure than in the case of lambda CDM. So not only you modify the universe as a whole, but you also modify the structure of a dark matter halo. You actually remove them. Now what you see is when we increase the cross-section, suddenly you lose all the little structure. And in fact, right now, what you see is that if the cross-section is too large, you sterilize the Milky Way. Now, it's clearly not what we observe. I mean, what you observe is not exactly called dark matter, but there are many more structures than, I mean, it's not a sterilized Milky Way. There are plenty of little structures. So we know it's not working. So that is important because just comparing, so this is the snapshot of the simulation, I have the numbers also if you want, but the comparison between all the snapshots tells you something very important. On the left, for cold dark matter, you see plenty of structure. On the right, you see many less structure, and this is warm dark matter. So this is a case where the dark matter has no interaction but is fairly light. And then you have all those cases here, where here we assume interactions but with a fairly large cross-section but not too large. So you see a reduction in the number of structure, but you still see a few structure. And here you basically increase the cross-section so much that there is no more little structures. So clearly this is excluded, and by comparing this the simulation to the observation, you can set a limit on the dark matter interaction. Now what we obtain, and we obtain it for a photon, but it's the same for the neutrinos, is the following. The cross-section is something like 10 to minus 33 for a particle of 1 GeV. Now, 10 to minus 43 centimeters square is getting close, it's not, but it's getting close to the weak interactions. So if I was pure weakly interacting, I would have something like 10 to minus 36 centimeters square. So we're fairly close, and for a particle of 1 MeV, you would actually say this is a weakly interacting massive particle. And even though it would be massive, I mean, it would be weakly interacting, you would actually change the structure of the Milky Way. So even though the cross-section would be small, you would have actually a reduction in the number of structure in the Milky Way. So that is quite surprising because I always tell, I mean, you know, everybody says dark matter is weakly interacting, this is a cold dark matter fluid, you can neglect the interactions. Well, if a particle was MeV and coupled to neutrinos, that's not true, you cannot, because you actually change the structure of the Milky Way itself. You change the structure of the universe and you change the structure of the Milky Way. Only, yeah. So it's a primordial effect.
There's no other effect?
No, okay. It's a primordial effect, so we don't assume that there is, again, interactions at late times. Just
primordial.
Yeah,
universe,
so. That's right. Yeah. And yet, it modifies everything.
And you're saying that like the directed current, like terrestrial experiments, don't really probe this?
So for dark matter photon, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's, well, it depends exactly on the mass, but it could be difficult. But for dark matter neutrino, yes, it's difficult. So this is an interesting question. So let me show you the next thing. So now let's say, well, actually, what happens if you have a candidate of 1 MeV and with such cross-section? Sorry, this is the same, so I can skip. Now, I'm just going to show you what happens with an effective theory. I mean, I'm not claiming this is valuable, but this is just what happens if you assume a simple model. So far I was doing scattering between dark matter and neutrinos. So this is a diagram here. I'm assuming a scalar particle, so but I can change. I mean, you could do something more complicated. But if you have this, you can reverse the diagram and you have annihilations, dark matter annihilation into neutrinos. So in effect, you can produce neutrinos. But the amazing thing is that if you have this diagram, you can also basically turn it, having the neutrino legs and close the dark matter loops. I mean, close the dark matter legs to make a loop. And in that case, what you get is a mass term for the neutrinos. Now, once you have this mass term, you can compute it, obviously, and it will depend on the mass of this particle N, which is the mediator, and it will depend on the characteristic of your dark matter particle, on the couplings. Now, Because it's exactly the same process as this one or this one. This one gives you the relic density. So you can say, well, you can make at least this assumption. So you can relate the neutrino mass to the relic density of the dark matter, right? So you can make a calculation which at the end gives you the mass of a neutrino in terms of the annihilation cross-section, or in other words, in terms of the relic density. There is no other things really involved. The rest is the mass of the mediator, the couplings. I mean, it's all contained here, basically. But now the thing is, again, if you assume a particle of MeV, one MeV, what you get is the mass of a neutrino exactly within the observed range. So strangely enough, so I'm not saying that there is anything maybe exciting in that, but it's a very strange coincidence. If a dark matter is one MeV, you get the right neutrino masses with such a diagram, which is an effective theory, so you would need to cook the proper theory. But you would get the proper neutrino mass, and also you get an effect in structure formation, and you get the right relic density. So you get everything in one go for one MeV, or a few MeV, for a particle as light as an electron. So you can question that, whether you can have even light dark matter, whether you can have MeV particles. So I'm sure Natalia would agree with me, you can. But at the time when we noticed that, it was not clear whether actually you could go as low as 1 MeV. And in fact, it was not clear whether you could even go down a few GeV. So the whole question...
Yeah, the question is, though, how did you get the coupling required?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. We're trying. I'm not finished. I was hoping to finish, but it's not finished, so I cannot. I don't really want to show it until. But you can. I think you can. It's not easy.
Is it through the heat or?
Yeah, you need something else indeed. Yeah, you need another particle. Here, no. I mean, here I'm just saying, okay, if I have this diagram, I just need to manipulate it, and it's okay.
Yeah, but it's not in situ invariant.
Yeah, it's not the theory. I totally agree. Yeah. You need to do something else. I'm just saying, if you can realize, if you have a model. So what we're doing now is basically managing to realize this model. Then you have it. I mean, then you can essentially do this manipulation. Yeah? So the question is really whether you can have light dark matter at the end, and in fact, can you have light thermal dark matter? And so, the diagram I showed is essentially this one. Now I generalize it. I'm saying, okay, I'm interested in having particles which annihilate into standard model particles. So instead of having neutrinos, I can put a fermion, any kind of fermion. But then I need the right mediator. So if it's a charged fermion, it's a charged final state, then I need a charged mediator. This is assuming scalar dark matter. I can do the same, assuming Majorana or Dirac dark matter. In this case, the mediator would be a scalar. Okay. For example, this is one possibility. So the thing is, what you notice immediately, or at least what I noticed at the time, is that for this diagram, when you compute the annihilation cross-section, you see that you need non-chiral couplings. But providing that, you don't have a dark matter mass which comes into play. So the cross-section is only depending on the mass of the mediator. So it's inversely proportional to the mediator mass. And that's because you're dealing with a scalar dark matter, so you don't have initially this mass which comes directly into the initial energy. But with a fermionic dark matter, it's the opposite. You have a dark matter mass, and you also have a mass of a mediator. So you have two scales. Now, what happens is that unless you go to a light mediator, you will need very large couplings to compensate for the difference of mass between the dark matter mass and the mediator. So with this diagram, if you want to have thermal dark matter, you need a light mediator. This one, it depends only on the mediator. You don't care about the dark matter mass anymore. So you can go to, with this one, you can consider MeV dark matter. As long as the mediator is not too heavy, that's fine. You can do it. With this one, you cannot. It's much more difficult. Okay. Now, the thing is, once you've done that, you say, okay, I like scalar mediator, scalar dark matter, then I can play with scalar dark matter. But then you have to be a little bit careful, because if you have such annihilation, so for example, I produce So I produce fermion antifermion, so I may well produce electrons and positrons. In that case, I could have the production of antimatter in the galaxy. And if I produce antimatter, if I produce positrons, I should have a signal. I should have gamma rays produced in the halo. So if you do some naive calculation, just assuming, you don't even have to do propagation like people do. I mean, just a naive count where you said every time I have an electron, I have a photon, just to get an order of magnitude. Then what you get is the following. So it's very, very naive, but it's just to show you the effect. The flux scales inversely, I mean, is inversely proportional to the dark matter mass square. So at 1 GeV, what you found is the flux of gamma rays in this kind of scenarios is compatible with the observation. So in principle, if you believe this kind of scenario, you would say, actually, you should see it at, if you have observation around 1 GeV, you should see it, you should discover it. So it's true, if I do the same refined calculation, that would be in between 1 and 10 GeV, you would see a signal. But then if you go down, you overproduce a gamma rays with a simple calculation of flux, where you assume that the cross-section is the one I mentioned before, and therefore it's a constant annihilation cross-section. So it's fixed, and if the dark matter is 1 MeV, you overproduce the flux of gamma ray by a factor 10 to the 6, so completely ruled out, which means that you would have to surprise the cross-section. But if you surprise the cross-section, then you have a problem with thermal dark matter. So once I realized that, I was saying, well, it's okay, because I can surprise this cross-section if I want. But in order to have a thermal dark matter, I can add to this diagram, for example, I could add another interaction, which would be based, at the time we called it U boson, and it's essentially what after we called light Z prime, and now it's kind of rebranded into into dark photons, but it's essentially the same. So if you involve this kind of diagram where you have a mediator, which is a vector mediator, in that case, the cross-section goes as a V square, where V is the dark matter velocity. And so in the galaxy, the signal is surprised by 6 orders of magnitude, and your flux is compatible with observation. So in this case, what you obtain is essentially something which is compatible with the observation. So the thing is, once you do that, then you could say, well, okay, this is the end of the story. I have a signal, I have an indirect detection signal, which is a little bit faint. However, if you count for the two diagrams, so this one and this one, then this one, even if it's surprised, may still contribute to the gamma ray signal. And what you obtain here is the following. So if you go to the MeV range, a very light mass range, and if you have those two type of diagram, for example, you may produce electrons and positrons with a low energy. Now, if you produce positrons with a low energy in the galactic center, then you can have an annihilation between those positrons and the electrons from the galactic bulge, and what you would produce is a positronium atom. And if you produce a positronium atom, you may see a 5-11 keV line. Now, people have observed a 5-11 keV line. They've seen it back in the 70s, and then they've seen it later on with the last experiment being SPI on integral satellite. And the thing is, what this experiment really brought is a map of the emission. And the map of emission is really interesting because it tells you that most of the emission is located in the galactic center and is rather spherical. It's not really true, but it's rather fitting a spherical emission. So if you had astrophysical sources, and you may have an explanation due to astrophysical sources, but the type of signal you would get is basically would be located in the galactic disk. So not only you would have an emission from the bulge, but you also have an emission clearly located in the galactic disk. So you would have something which you can correlate. Now, this is not what you observe. At the time, they couldn't even observe any signal coming from the galactic disk. Now they can, but it's much suppressed with respect to the center. So what this tells you is that maybe it's an astrophysical source, but it's an astrophysical source emitting positrons, which is located in the galactic center. So the question is, what kind of source can do that? And in fact, there is none, really, none appealing. It could be the dark matter, but if it's dark matter, then you need to make sure that the dark matter is light enough. So all those diagrams, for example, those one would be relevant. The problem with that is that if you have, for example, dark matter annihilating into electron positron, through this diagram, you need a mediator which is charged. In order to explain the flux which is seen, you need a particle which is around 100 GeV, a little bit more, but a few hundred GeV. You didn't see this type of particle at LHC, so you have some constraints. Now, if you have this kind of diagram, maybe it works, but there are constraints like Nathalie and Philippe are looking at. And then the other thing is, it's not necessarily a good fit because this cross-section has this dark matter velocity dependence. And when you try to see whether this is fitting the morphology of a signal, you see that it's not a perfect match. Maybe there is more work to do, but this type of interactions, it's not perfect. However, this is what happens when you do when you go to the light mass range. You do have to worry about all those signals, not only because maybe you can explain them, but they also tell you what's there, what kind of emission is there, and that constrains your signal. For example, if I have 100 MeV dark matter annihilating into electron positrons, I do not want to produce more signal than there is here. So you have to be very careful. And I'm saying this because, for example, so in the paper, we were interested in between 1 and 10 GeV. But for example, as I said before, so if I go back here, if I have a particle of a few GeV, in principle, I was saying, well, I could almost see it because the emission would correspond to the observation, really. But you have to be a little bit careful because what's going to happen is that you are going, if you have a particle of, let's say, 10 GeV, you can annihilate into electrons, but you can also annihilate into BB bars. But those BB bars are going to produce electrons and positrons, and they're going to produce gamma rays, so you have to compute all this chain, all this hadronization, and the production of a photon due to the chain. Now what you get, so if you just look at the galactic center and see whether you can have light less than 10 GeV dark matter annihilating and producing some gamma ray in the galactic center, yes, you can, indeed, you can see them. And in fact, people have seen an excess. Whether this excess is relevant for dark matter or not is another matter, but at least you know that you have some room where, in principle, you can have a few GeV dark matter annihilating into standard model particles. Now, precisely because you have an excess, and this is exactly what I told you before, you have room for an excess because the flux is not so... the flux is exactly what you can measure at the moment, so it's normal to see an excess. Then what you can explain is annihilation precisely into BB bars. This is assuming that that there is no propagation. And then you can redo the same exercise assuming that there is propagation. So this means that when you have you annihilate into BB bars, you're going to produce electrons and positrons, but they're not going to stay where they've been produced. They can actually diffuse out. And as they diffuse out, they produce gamma rays, which can be extended. So the emission is a bit different. And you have to be careful whether this corresponds to your observations or not. So this is this kind of plot, but I'm not sure you're interested in it. I guess I'm very close to the deadline.
How well do we know the distribution of dark matter in our own galaxy?
Fairly well. We know it. I could have had a diagram. We know it very well. Well, we know it enough, let's say, for those constraints to be relevant. So the error bars of this are larger than the error bars from the distribution. That was not true. So that was late, depending on who is doing the analysis, really. But I think we know it. Fairly enough. So there was a few months ago. I think there was an analysis by Bertonnet, a group by Bertonnet, in Nature, and you can see the distribution. So I'm just tell me.
So you reckon
the time for 15
minutes.
Okay. So maybe I have time just to make a point then about direct detection. So just one thing. So if I assume that, I try to show you that you can have relatively light dark matter particles. And they can be lighter than 10 GeV, but you have to be careful because the gamma rays constrain the type of particles you can think about. Now, if you think less than 10 GeV, there are not so many experiments which can constrain them from the type of, you can constrain them using indirect detection, but you cannot constrain them using direct detection. It's a little bit more tricky because most of the experiments are based on a heavy nuclei, and the signal would be somewhere here where you, or lower than that in that range, where you have no sensitivity, essentially. But at 10 GeV, just at 10 GeV, you had many claims a few years ago. Many experiments were telling that they've seen something. It's not that surprising, because in reality, 10 GeV correspond to a threshold of experiment. So you know that this is precisely where they can see things simply because they're not sensitive enough, or they're not good enough. However, there was one cogent, which initially a lot of people got excited about. And I thought, maybe this is, you know, maybe this is true. Maybe there is a signal there, and you have to be careful. Now, cogent is an experiment which collects signal from a basically from their detector, but they cannot discriminate whether what they see is a signal or a background. So they collect everything, and then they have to reconstruct what is signal, what is background. So the only thing I really want to show you is how I think they bias their analysis. So what they see is, okay, an ensemble of points, and essentially they have this curve, they measure this, they tell you per energy, this is the number of counts that they see. It's per energy bin. Now, this curve is obtained by looking at the time rise of the event in the detector. Now, the detector is very good inside, so there is a bulk, which is extremely good, and then surrounding the detector, there is a layer which is not very good in collecting the information. So a signal which is in the bulk actually is very fast, produces a signal very fast, and a signal which is on the layer of a detector, on the surface of a detector, takes more time to develop because the layer is not very good, the surface is not very good. So what you see is, if you look at the rise time of events, you see this plot where you have lots of points, but they claim that here you see, they claim they have two signals. They claim they have one here and one here, which you see going up. Okay, so if you assume that they're right, that indeed there are two signals here, then you can try to fit this. They use two log normals. They claim that this is the way to fit the signals for the detector. So you have one log normal, which would be here, and then another log normal, which is a blue curve, which would be this one. Now the red one, because it goes fast, would be the bulk, so the signal. And the blue one, which takes more time, would be precisely events in the layer of a detector, so precisely the background. So in principle, if you're able to do this fit, you know which events are the background, which events are the signal. Now the problem is a log normal has three parameters. Two log normals is six parameters. So you need to do a fit of these things with large error bars with six parameters. So you can already infer that you're going to have lots of uncertainty on the fit. But never mind, let's continue. So you say, okay, now I can do this fit. I can find the best parameter for each of the log normal in order to fit the signal and get the whole picture. And this is the rise time, but for every energy bin, you would have this kind of plot. So for every energy bin, you can find the number of events which looks like the signal and the number of events which looks like the background. Then what you have to do is you basically integrate those two signals, you take the ratio of them, and for every single energy bin, you put the ratio. So you obtain points, we bin them on top of that, but you obtain those points. And then what you have to do is a fit again of those points. So what this curve is telling you is that here you have, so it's a fraction of signal versus background. So this is the number of events. Sorry, so here, for example, you obtain 0.4 at those energy. This means that out of all the events that you have, only 0.4 or 40% are a signal and 60 are the background. And out of this point here, which is, let's say, 0.2, you have only 20% which looks like a signal and the rest is just background. So you have to take this curve and multiply with basically what they had initially, and that gives you the type of signal that is left, the type of really the dark matter candidate. Okay, so in principle, it's all fine. But the real question is this curve here is correct? So if it's true, at low energy, I have only 20% of events which could look like a dark matter signal. Well, here, I have 40%. What they claim is that the signal is precisely at low energy, where I had only 20%. So you really have to pay attention to the green curve that is here. And when we've done it, what we realize is that what they took is not this green curve. It's not actually what is the best fit, what they took is a much better, I mean, is a curve which allowed to have much more dark matter. They took this curve here, which maybe you don't see, it's too faint, but this is a blue, I mean, a purple curve, which go up to 40% of signal instead of 20%. And they've done that because obviously that fits their experiment, but in reality, you should have been taking the best fit, so you should have been taking a curve which was more, I mean, which prevented you to have so much signal. So in reality, you could say, well, this is the best fit, but you could take all the others and just wait by the probability that they give you a quality of fit. And at the end, after all this work, I'll just show you the result, what we found is that there is less than one sigma evidence for dark matter in cogent. So in reality, I really believe that by taking actually this curve, which was the most optimistic case where you had 40% of signal at low energy, they totally biased the analysis. They should have been really careful on this specific case. Okay, so just the future for me for the dark matter field is really the complementarity between all those experiments. But I believe that now with galactic survey, we are actually reaching the range where we can prove the dark matter interactions. They're still quite large. Unfortunately, it's not as compelling as I would like. But we start with, I mean, this is a new technique, and we will have more and more data. And so, for example, with the new galaxy survey called DAISY, what we can achieve now is we can probe. Initially, I told you with the CMB, you can find cross-section around 10 to minus 4, the Thomson cross-section. But with DAISY, you can gain even a factor 10 already. It's just a galactic survey which goes a little bit deeper than the others. So in terms of redshift, so BOSS that you know probably is stopping here. So redshift 2 maximum. And then you can see that DAISY goes around 4. And then also in terms... And LSTST is here. Yeah, it goes up to 6, 7. Yeah.
Will it continue as a
study,
or what is DAISY?
Sorry, DAISY is the same. It's the same as BOSS, but it's a new generation. So so you see many more galaxies, much further. Yeah. So with DAISY, you can gain a factor 10 already in the cross section. So my conclusion, basically, I think we can probe the dark matter microphysics using direct detection, indirect detection, and LHE, but I do believe that we can try also now with large-scale survey. It's going to be tough, but I think it will provide a new information. And the difference is that we don't need to make any assumption. Unlike the direct detection, you need to assume that the particle is heavy enough to interact in your detector. Indirect detection, you need to assume it annihilates or decay. LHE, well, you need to produce it, but it needs to be in the right range with the right sensitivity. Large-scale survey, you just use the data, and you can constrain whatever you can. So that's it. Yeah. Thank you.
Self-interactions.
Yeah, so with self-interactions, the thing is, if you really want to do self-interactions, it's almost impossible because you need large cross-section for the following reason with the, just with this expression, so if you're just doing self-interactions alone, you need dark matter density and you need the dark matter velocity, they both suppress. So this means that you will need a very large cross-section to compensate for the suppression. Now, when you have this very large cross-section between two particles of the same nature, you change the notion of fluid. You don't have a fluid anymore. And all the equations are, all the formalism is for a fluid. It's always assume a fluid. So if you start to change that, you need to change the way you deal with it. So the trick to reproduce self-interactions is not to couple the dark matter with itself, but to couple it to a dark photon. And so in principle, you just add a new equation, etc. So that we've done. Many other people have done it. And then you can compute the primordial power spectrum and then do the simulation. So the one who's done it recently was Jesus Zavala, for example. You see the same oscillations and you see the same suppression. But the cross section is Thomson, basically. It's around 10 to minus 20 25 centimeters square. It's not, it's really not a weak interaction.
So there is one more transitive effect, like an array structure at most cases. That's a very light
definitely.
Mm-hmm. Axioms. Yeah, axioms,
yeah.
So how would you tell the two apart?
That's the thing. So this is, I guess you're referring to the work of Dodi Marsh.
So how would you tell the two apart? That's a question.
So in principle, so with Dodi, we wanted to check actually how can you distinguish them. So in principle, we were looking. So the CMB is a little bit different, and then the power spectrum is a little bit different, and then the question is whether the simulation can pick up the difference, and it's not clear. From our discussion,
what is the smallest scale you'll be able to plot
with a simulation?
With the simulation principle, it's as small as you want, let's say, but with the service.
So, yeah, so I think, so directly, I think it's still a big 1 megaparsec, so it's a big galaxy. But indirectly, it's around 100 kiloparsec.
Oh, okay. So it's reaching galactic.
Yeah. Well, even one megaparsec is a galaxy, but 100 kiloparsec is good because then you can probe the dwarf. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess I was a bit curious. So for axions, would it be a different type of interaction because it would be like coherent and scattering of photons?
It's so light that. But the Brody wavelength is huge,
so it's a coherence.
Size smaller than its size, right?
No, that's one thing. But so you're already talking about interacting with photons.
It's coherence
it's
life. Yeah,
particles.
Yeah. It's a coherence life. It's a different.
Sure.
But you still have a suppression. So indeed, then the question is whether you can distinguish. So you have a whole. You have lots of. Basically, you have a class of models which predict the suppression, and then. Can you tell them apart? So this is going to become very interesting as people improve the simulations and the observations, because for a moment it all looked like CDM, but the moment where you would have some small difference, you would have to think whether it is physics or just a problem of accuracy.
Well, I mean, I think at that level, it shouldn't be hard to distinguish it because. One of them is just suppressing initial power spectrum. The other is kind of a phase space constraint that you're saying.
No. Why?
No, because it's the axiom phase space. Because they're very light, then you can never get. Basically, it's Heisenberg ensemble principle for axioms. So it's not the question of initial condition, it's something at any point has to be satisfied. And but then this thing is something that's just done at this level of initial condition. And. So basically, I can imagine if you just look at the tails of different sizes, the way they would appear would be different. I don't know if anybody has looked at this, but I'm saying that it's just different effects. They're not the same.
No, physically they're different. In principle, they should be different. The question is how well can you tell apart the available data, right?
Yeah.
So
it depends also if you have effects at late time again. Well, maybe indeed with a phase space you may be able to distinguish, but.
Any other questions?
I think I missed one basic point. When you say it's a forced way of detecting dark matter, you mean detecting that it interacts with some other matter? Is that what you mean?
So it's really trying to probing whether it has weak interactions or not. Yeah.
So it's more like trying to.
The microphysics, that's right.
And if you take the more pessimistic view, to some people might be the optimistic view, you would set new kinds of bounds on
that's
interaction
right.
strengths.
That's right, yeah.
The dark
yeah, yeah. So for example, for MEV particle, I can say it has to be weakly interacting. For GEV particle, the cross-section is 10 to minus 33 centimeters square, so this is the most you can, if you couple it to neutrino or photon, this is the most you can do. If it's TEV, then okay, the cross-section is 10 to minus 30 centimeters square, it's fairly large. There are plenty of other constraints. But at least for a moment, for the low mass range is good, and I hope that with more data, then you can improve and then you can constrain heavier particles. So.
Okay, thank you.